This podcast for the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression is brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at civilpodcast.com.
Good evening. Get started. I'm sorry for the delay, but I think you'll find it very much worth the wait. My name is Josh Wheeler. I'm the Associate Director of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression, the sponsors of tonight's program. I'd like to just begin and say a few words of thanks to the people whose hard work has made this event possible. Amy McClung, my colleague at the Thomas Jefferson Center. Amy's mother, who always gets drafted into helping, but or at least she pretends to very happily volunteer to do her part in setting up chairs, taking them down, and everything else. Also, to our two summer interns, Rebecca Shaw and Samson Hosty. They have our thanks. They didn't have a choice about helping out, but they nonetheless did so with great enthusiasm, and we're very grateful. You know, as I look out on this crowd on this beautiful, beautiful evening of August 14th, 1807, I can't help but think how much we residents of Western Virginia have to be proud of. In the first place, one of our neighbors,
good to see you, sir.
Thomas Jefferson, currently serves as president of these United States. Thomas Jefferson, a neighbor of us, and somebody many of you know personally. But in addition, we have equal pride in another neighbor from nearby Orange County, serving us in the highest levels of government. Mr. James Madison was instrumental in securing the enactment of the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom in 1786. He has been called the father of the Constitution for his role in establishing the new United States Constitution in 1787. And in 1789, he led the way in Congress to amend the Constitution to include what are now the first 10 amendments, the first of the 12 amendments to the Constitution, but the first 10 now often known as the Bill of Rights. And for the past 6 years, he has served as the Secretary of State in the administration of President Thomas Jefferson. It is now my honor to introduce to you a great American, a great citizen, and a neighbor of ours in Orange County, the Honorable James Madison.
Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. Citizens of Charlotte, I am most pleased to be back here amongst your number. Many of you have known that through an arduous campaign in 1789, I began an eight-year presentation as a representative from this particular district to the United States Congress. I'm not all that unfamiliar with your circumstances, and certainly I've retained a very fond friendship with one of your own neighbors, Mr. Jefferson, the President. This evening, I wish to express my appreciation to address you on some of the subjects that now address the present administration here in 1807, and then perhaps without much tarriness to address some of the questions that you may have either on the current state of matters or on matters that allude to the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or other subjects that have come before our young republic over the last 18 years. First, I suppose I should inquire whether those in the back can hear my voice or not. I have symbols that they do. I'm not quite sure that they actually do, but they may be hearing just enough to satiate their appetites. I should announce, first of all, that due to the unfortunate event that occurred in the end of June, firing on the USS Chesapeake and by the HMS Leopard, that the President has already ordered that all our ports should be shut to British shipping, that they will not be used to refit any British ships, and that as, for now, we are prohibiting any manner of British trade in American ports. This is in direct action to that reprehensible action on the part of the British, one of a litany of circumstances that have placed our country with England in most difficult, most unfortunate terms. I should also say that in the Mediterranean, In consequence of the firing of the USS Chesapeake, the damage to the ship, the injury to the crew, and death of some of them, and that the ship is not proceeding to the Mediterranean, where it had originally been endeavored to replace the Constitution, the USS Constitution, as the head of the fleet in the Mediterranean. The captain of the USS Constitution is Mr. Bonner's brother. Captain Bonner was the one who was captain of the USS Chesapeake. These matters, as well as the attention to the Mediterranean and the manner of the Barbary pirates, that we have found that at least four of the sultanates that had been such a problem are now reduced to merely one. We have secured a treaty with the Pasha of Tripoli 2 years ago. We have also had numerous discussions with the ambassador from Morocco to the United States. And we have also been able to establish some degree of peace and tranquility with Tripoli. It is now Tunis that may give us problems in that part of the world. We have also undertaken a redress of grievances to the French regarding the imposition of the edicts from Milan and Berlin. These actions by Napoleon and the French government were placed upon American shipping neutral trade in order to restrict any trade with England, either direct or indirect. They are on the heels of similar actions on the part of the British over the last year to impose an alteration to the Orders in Council and the Rule of 1756, by which the British determine the legitimacy of neutral trade in the world according to their own terms. These actions, both by the French and the British, have restricted American neutral trade considerably. Our merchant ships, which have been certainly one of the largest carrying trade in the world, indeed the largest in 1805, only 2 years ago, have been greatly prohibitive. And any visit to any port town in these United States may recognize the building of articles, of stores, of wares that were bound for foreign ports that are not now endeavoring to be sent, captains and owners of these ships being reluctant to submit American shipping to the seizure by the French and the British. These are very, very difficult times for our merchant trade. And the effects of the success of that merchant trade affect all the citizens in all of the states. And so we are taking such steps as we may to alter the circumstances with the French and the British to bring about a more favorable situation for we Americans. And the actions that have been taken thus far have been most deliberate and most restrained. We have already been subject in this administration to clamors from New Hampshire, from the governor there, Governor Langdon, and the legislature, calling for a complete embargo of American trade abroad, that we may force England and France in their present war to reduce their restrictive measures, and thus force them, by the nature of the deprivation of their goods and articles to carry on their war, into more complacent responses to American overtures in their direction. We presently have John Armstrong as our minister plenipotentiary in France, Mr. James Bowdoin in Spain, and Mr. Monroe, also a neighbor of ours, and Mr. Timothy Pickering in England, both of those gentlemen seeking to secure a convention with England that may reduce the tensions between the two nations. This, in short, is the difficulties we've encountered with the British and the French. We have had also some difficulties with the Spanish and their claims in Western Florida, as well as the western boundaries of the Louisiana Territory and the province of Texas. But we have made considerable strides, hopefully with the Spanish, to reduce the tensions there. We have last December received the report of our illustrious expedition to the west under the command of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. The report has not been given in entirety, but Mr. Lewis did return last December and gave us sterling accounts of the flora and fauna in that part of the world, as well as the treatment with some of the tribes to be found in that quarter of the world. It's been a most extraordinary and beneficial journey, and that, with the purchase of Louisiana Territory, may widen the scope for Americans for generations to come, and perhaps also provide that means of revenue to reduce our national debt rather than imposing further taxes on the citizens and on the businesses and the imports and exports that are now proceeding from this country and to this country. It has been the policy of Mr. Hamilton to suggest funding bills and other manners of financial arrangements which have proven such an encumbrance, particularly upon those in Virginia and other southern states. With the accrual of Louisiana Territory and with the progressive sale of those lands, we may find the reduction of our national debt continuing year by year. As it is already, Mr. Jefferson will be reporting to the Congress in October that we have reduced the national debt now to $16 million. And this is in contrast to the original $55 million Mr. Hamilton had judged our country to owe at the outset of this new nation under the Constitution. It's the most extraordinary alteration of monies, and certainly to the benefit of the people at large. And this is a report of the Secretary of State. I'm hoping that there may be questions amongst you as I look upon your assembly and note the number of blank faces addressing me. It might well indicate some inability to comprehend that which I've already said. But as a public figure who rarely speaks before such congregations, I can assure you this is far more difficult for me to say than it is for any of you to understand. I might also note the number of ladies in our company here this afternoon, gentlemen. It's the most extraordinary report of enthusiasm of the nation at large for public concerns, and I'm delighted to have their company. I can only hope, of course, they will not become overbearing and next desire the vote. Many gentlemen suggest that it may only double the influence of young ladies already over the outcome of political events in this country. It becomes a nation of Lysistratas as they try to prevent the Peloponnesian Wars, and ladies try to direct the political activities of our nation. I am pleased to see a number of familiar faces here in the assembly, and hopefully that the warmth of the moment would allow you a degree of informality that I'm afraid that the circumstances being presented before the Secretary of State would otherwise not allow. Are there any questions from amongst your number at all? Yes. There is a suggestion that the nature of events as they have proceeded, particularly since the choosing of Governor Clinton as the Vice President in 1805, seems to lend itself to that conclusion. Running for any office is such a presumption on the part of a gentleman that I hesitate to employ that particular terminology. If anything, one would run from such an office rather than run toward it. But I suspect with the tradition that has already been established, even in the brief years of 18 years of our nation, we have seen each vice president succeed the president. To Governor Clinton, formerly from New York, is somewhat advanced in age and has not expressed any interest at all in the position of president. And I understand that there may be some effort on the part of those in Congress and those other members of Democratic Republican parties in various states to suggest my name. I will not refuse it, but I am not unaware of the hazards that may be attendant to such a position and the aspersions and animadversions that may be cast upon my character for lack of prior experience in any administration. But the precedent that has been set by Mr. Jefferson, those that are presently in his administration, and the general well-being of the people at large may allow the continuation of the policies of Mr. Jefferson to continue for the next 8 years. And if that be my lot, then I should certainly not refuse it. Yes, sir.
Yes, you've amply explained how our trade with Britain and France has been an economic boost to our country and has helped reduce the debt. But now all that trade has been stopped because of the acts of war against us. And I understand also that our naval fleet has been reduced to about 6 ships or something on that order. If you were president, what position would you take so we could more amply maintain our free trade?
Well, the prohibition to free trade now emanates from the policies of the French and the British. Their present war has placed each of them into the disposition of restricting any nation that would assist their particular enemy at the time. England has already declared a blockade from essentially from Ligurno all the way to the northern parts of Denmark. It is a paper blockade, but any American ship found going into such a port may be subjected to seizure and subjected to claims in courts, in admiralty courts, as to the nature of the goods that they're transporting, the origins of those goods, and their destination. This restrictive measure on the part of the British is what is restricting American trade to much of Europe presently. We have also similar actions on the part of the French, although perhaps less enforceable on the part of the French than on the part of the British. The French do act in the Caribbean considerably, and any French warship that may find an American ship may seize it. And the claim that it is undergoing some action which is contrary to the French and the English. We must keep in mind that while these restrictions are now being placed on American trade, these restrictions that are contrary to any understanding of international law, where that body of law would seek to encourage neutral trade and discourage those warring parties in the world at large. Yet the warring parties are now restricting this neutral trade. We also have a circumstance where our trade with South America and in the China trade is also increasing, that is less inhibited by the French and the English accents. But if we are to improve our situation, building more ships will not answer the cause. We could not possibly build the ships at the rate necessary to protect all our neutral trade in all parts of the world, considering the vast array of English ships that are out there already and the advance that the French Navy has also. So we must turn to diplomatic means to reduce this threat on American trade. And we can do so by prohibiting the exportation of those goods that may assist those warring parties and thus force either one of them to a more complacent response to American demands, and thus reestablishing their trade and perhaps even a most favored trade nation status. We would be able to force them by economic means rather than by military means into a more agreeable stance. I might also add parenthetically that while American trade is now being restricted, France and England both retain cartels between the two nations. They are actively engaging in a trade, these two warring nations, with each other. They are also allowing trade with their respective colonies around the world. And yet, at the same time, they're restricting American neutral trade. It is unconscionable. But if we are to respond, let us respond with the strength that we have, the resolve of the American people, to ultimately ameliorate the situation with our foreign trade, and to do so by that power which is very much Americans, their desire for liberty, the desire for freedom, the desire for reason and moderation in all that they do, and the vast resources that we possess here in North America. And that way we will compel the British or the French to respond more favorably to our demands and reestablish that element of trade. These may be hard times in the months ahead, but I believe we're up to it.
Is that the problem, though, that it's going to hurt our people more than it's going to hurt the British or French by restricting the exportation?
It is true that we may suffer somewhat in our possessions, in the luxuries that we may possess. But what a small price that is compared to the possible loss of life. We already suffer in our trade considerably by the restrictions already imposed upon us by the French and the British. We are only making that circle of defense all the more strong by the prospects of an embargo. It has not yet been decided whether we shall do so or not, but these are some of the calls already coming from some of the state governments and state governors. And so the restriction really will not be that different than the condition in which we find ourselves already, and may have the more compelling force of not having any access to American goods on the part of these warring nations that may compel them to a more reasonable stand. Yes, sir.
Secretary Madison, at this time, this had been a nation for about 100 years, and slavery had been going on before that, and it was going to continue for another three-quarter of a century. And shipping would have a lot to do with the slave shipment. Was there a silence by you and your boss, Jefferson, on the question of slavery at this time?
No silence at all, sir. No silence at all. When the Constitution was written, we had placed within it that position of our government that by the year 1808 we would no longer allow the importation of slavery into this nation. That is just around the corner and is also part of the announcement that Mr. Jefferson will be making in his October address to the Congress when it reconvenes. And the effort, of course, to restrict slavery into this country will go a long way to reducing the institution itself. Internally, even in my own plantation, the nature of the institution is not only reprehensible morally, but also is economically unsound. And we will find the small undoing of that unfortunate institution as the years proceed. It is necessary, of course, to consider the nature of our society when alterations and manumission come about, that there are so many elements of the society involved in that issue. Some very much against any reduction to the institution of slavery, some adamant for its abolition. And it has been a divisive factor in this nation considerably for some amount of time. One would even say that during the process of writing the Constitution and securing its ratifications amongst the states, that there were so many adverse to removing slavery as an institution, particularly in the southern states. I remember James Jackson from Georgia declaiming on the legitimacy of slavery in the Bible and all sorts of references to the authorities that would allow the institution to continue. We were faced with that difficult task of ascertaining whether we should impose an abolition to slavery, to immediately seek its reduction, if not its elimination, and in so doing, hazard the nation falling into several different confederations. The prospect of arranging the Constitution as we had lent the greatest prospects of success removing that institution by establishing the nature of this republic, inculcating in the people at large the spirit of liberty and independence, and the nature of free citizens. What more glorious goal could be established by any Republican government than to say that the ends of government and the means of government are to secure the ultimate liberties and freedom of all within the nation. In so doing, we set the course, the pace. We have set the ambition for this nation that hopefully will be find subsequent generations being able to answer these questions more efficaciously than we can here. But at least the initial steps of preventing the importation of slavery into this nation have been taken and will be taken next year. And that trade will have then little to do with the importation of slaves. That sure is a short answer to a much wider question. And I don't know whether it responds to the question you're asking, except you did mention slavery and manner of trade. And I believe that's going to be answered next year with the abolition of all importation of slavery. Yes?
Yes. I'm particularly thankful for your work in getting the Constitution passed and the Bill of Rights, and particularly the ideas of separation of power between the branches of government and separation of church and state. In fact, I think your views in the Federalist Paper number 10 certainly speak of that. I attended a meeting Saturday of some Republicans, and the speaker seemed to try to get the idea, because the Creator was mentioned four times in the Bill of Rights, that the Constitution established the United States as a Christian nation instead of a nation of Christians and others. I would like your views on your belief in the Constitution as a secular document.
Well, first of all, I've never laid claim to writing any of those Federalist Papers, as you so generously seem to suggest. And I should probably set the record straight on that presently. Secondly, the nature of this question of church and state has been addressed on other occasions. It is a difficult question, but is one in which a response is not to equivocate. When we sought to form a Republican form of government, We found the energies, the means, the faculties, and the resources in the people at large, as were reflected certainly by those at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. Former Republican governments are a political action. They require the acquiescence of the people at large for the legitimacy of the action itself. When we are in a pre-political state, before man was even involved in tribes or in communities or in towns or cities or even nations, in this pre-political state, we are born into the world as creatures of providence. We are born into the world with a relationship with the Creator that is singular to each of us. Our perceptions of that relationship are very important. They deal with the very right of personal conscience and the manner by which we respond, by which we perceive the relationship between ourselves and our Creator. That ecclesiastic relationship between man and God exists before governments are even instituted. It is a sacred relationship. It is viewed, however, in many different ways by many different peoples in the world. But it is an ecclesiastic relationship. And it is so important and so critical that no government should render it asunder. No government has the right to tell an individual what the relationship to the Creator is. No government should dictate the nature of citizens' practices and their religion. It is important to realize that for some number of years, many state governments imposed the state religion on the people. In Virginia alone, the integration between the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church, and the political society in Virginia were almost indistinguishable. When the Revolution came about in 1776, the dissatisfaction in Virginia rested not only on the political actions of England, but also represented dissatisfactions with the representations of the Anglican Church. Those who were Baptists, those who were Presbyterians, those who were Moravians, those who were Quakers, were fined for preaching without a license. And in many instances would not be given that license. Their freedom to practice their religion, to exercise their freedom of consciousness with their Creator, was abridged by the action of the state and also certainly by the church. And so in forming a new Republican government, this is one of the actions we wish to prevent. We are also to understand that the ecclesiastic world rests in and of itself. It does not require the sanction of the state to render one's relationship to God legitimate or to dictate what that relationship should be. In this respect, the ecclesiastic relationship we have in this world is God-given and thus entirely without sanction or need for support from the state. On the other hand, the Republican government reformed in 1787, ratified by the several states, is a government that does not receive its legitimacy because it's sanctioned by God. God did not ratify the Constitution. People ratified the Constitution. They ratified that form of government which they would concede as legitimate. The Constitution retains its legitimacy on the basis of the consent of the people at large, and thus does not require ecclesiastic sanction for its legitimacy, for its existence. We must be careful in all that we do politically and religiously to keep this distinction in mind. For any crossover, any effort on the part of the government to obtrude on the nature of ecclesiastic relationships between the people and their Creator will only have adverse effects, generally have more adverse effects than positive effects. And correspondingly, any action of government upon ecclesiastic relationships will also tend to restrict one or another of our number in consequence of the nature of that action. God does prevail in this nation. He shall allow the preachers and the priests and the parsons and the ministers to declaim such. But in the political world, in the political actions of a government, it must depend upon its support by the people at large and cannot necessarily address God for the nature of political responses. The people themselves, however, ever faithful, perhaps moral in their inclinations, will choose moral representatives, will choose virtue in a representative over a lack of virtue in a representative. They will judge their representatives on the ability of that representative to render a moral judgment, to be virtuous in his actions. And insofar as God may guide the people individually, perhaps then God may have an effect upon the outcome of political matters. But the actions of the government are actions of the people. I am entirely content with that arrangement. I have seen the effects of the alternative and found it worse than anything we have presently. I hope that answers the question. Are there others? Yes. The nature of the structure of the government that was addressed during the Constitutional Convention was very important to convey to the national government. The national government in terms of its scope, not necessarily in terms of its authority. The federal government is a division of authority between the states and the national government. But within the realm of the national government, there was a conspicuous effort to divide authority. What authority we're going to give to the government must be divided amongst elements of that government. It is the perception of those at that convention, and still resides amongst many of the more reasoned individuals in our nation, to believe that any action on any part of government would receive a corresponding action on some other branch of government that may object to it. You present a hypothetical situation of a future president usurping the Constitution. Well, ultimately, any action of the government must rest upon the responsibility in the shoulders of the people at large. But sometimes these actions can take place before a general referendum may be had. It is then the responsibility of other members of the government itself, particularly in the Congress, but also should such actions be submitted to courts for review, for the courts also to ascertain the direction of the president. We had a case in point with the objections to the purchase of Louisiana Territory nearly 4 years ago. And it was suggested that Mr. Jefferson acted outside the bounds of the Constitution in purchasing Louisiana Territory. That objection did not receive much political favor in the nation. There were some who cried out against it. But in a sense, the action of the president taken on part of the Constitution and the Commerce Clause, and also even the suggestion of writing a new amendment to the Constitution to permit it, it was even suggested in the administration, indeed I believe it was Mr. Jefferson himself who suggested that we write an amendment giving the government the authority to purchase Louisiana Territory, and particularly the president. I objected to that amendment. I suggested if any such amendment be needed to be added to the Constitution, that it be general in nature to allow the purchase of any property on the part of the government. But where are we when we start revising the Constitution, with each particular instance requiring an alteration of the powers of the government so that there's presumably no ambiguity in it? Well, the Commerce Clause certainly allows for the government to regulate trade. And in this respect, the Louisiana Territory was added as a consequence, with little objections from the people at large. I perhaps would have to know the specifics of your imagined president, but I hope that you may find redress of grievances in the other branches of government itself, if they are acting properly. Yes, in the back. The question was what role my wife might play should I become president. I can only answer that we have had such a relationship, sir, that she has been intricately involved in many of the issues that I address as Secretary of State. She's been very engaged in assisting Mr. Jefferson, particularly at the outset of his administration in 01 and 02 when we first moved to the District of Columbia, to Washington City. And assisting certainly in the social arrangements at dinners. My wife exhibits a perspicuity and a discerning mind, a penetration of observation. And in times when we've had representatives from abroad at table with the administration, she has afterwards given a most extraordinary account of her observations on the nature and character of those individuals involved. The perception and contributions my wife may make, should I become president, and that's a very great leap between now and the end of next year, would be extraordinary. It's one of the reasons why I rather facetiously mentioned the idea of voting for ladies earlier. I hope no one here took me seriously. There are elements already in this country where women are voting in New Haven and other places. Such decision of suffrage is a decision, however, by the respective states. It's not a national question. And the nature of engaging women in the matters of the day, in commercial and social and political matters, can only increase the general benefit to the society as a whole. I can't believe that any reasoned man would suggest that the faculty of mind is a consequence of one's gender. That indeed the nature of contributions on the part of women have been extraordinary already, and that I suspect it will continue to be so in the years to come.
Sir. Madison, you've been characterized as the father of the U.S. Constitution. Are there any aspects of the Constitution that which you're particularly proud, and any for which you would are not so proud?
The question was addressed as to that element of the Constitution with which I might be proud, and that element with which I am somewhat rueing the fact that it was included. Am I correct? I am extremely pleased that the Constitution was ratified. It underwent an extraordinary examination in those 4 months in Philadelphia with some of the best and reasoned minds of the people in the country there to give comment and give direction to that convention. It is extraordinary to account for the frailty of human existence when educated and reasoned men may gather and differ on so many points that are so essential to the government at large. It shows the frailty of the human mind that so many reasoned, educated men can disagree on particular points. The fact that the Constitution was written, that it was submitted to the people, ratified without amendments as a qualification for the ratification, was very gratifying to me. But it was not to lull me into any degree of submission to the spirit of the people in support of this Constitution. There were many elements acting against it. Here in Virginia, I can give an account of the difficulties in being elected to the first Congress, the exercise and activities of a former governor and some of his cohorts. Nearly placed the whole issue of the Constitution in jeopardy when they made actions and took actions during the Richmond Constitutional Convention to impose conditions on the ratification of the Constitution. Virginia, as you know, is the largest state in the Union. Had Virginia not ratified, the consequences to the Union would have been severe and probably would have rendered it a moot point. That of New York also, which ratified after Virginia in July of 1788, would have done a great damage to the success of the Constitution. It was necessary for Virginia and New York to join the Union, even if nine other states had already ratified. So the whole process that the Constitution was written, submitted to the states, and ratified by the people in convention was of great satisfaction to me. There was also some points that I felt could have been judged a little differently. I had for some time suggested that state laws being written would have to more readily conform to the spirit of the national government, and also that the Congress itself might be engaged in writing laws that might undermine the spirit of the Constitution and its operation. And so I had recommended a commission to be formed to oversee both state legislative law as well as national law. And that would have perhaps been, I thought, an improvement at the time. But as the convention went on and the authorities, the authority of the Congress and the various checks on the Congress by other elements of the government helped to render that somewhat a moot point. I think we perhaps could have been a little bit more attentive to the judicial branch and the implications of the introduction of the national judiciary, the Supreme Court. In the formation of district courts in this nation, we formed 13 different districts in the federal court system. And these districts, by the nature of the districts, are large. The District of Virginia incorporates the whole Commonwealth of Virginia. And many objections of the Constitution rested on the impropriety of having district courts of such a large nature. An offense to the national government taking place here in Charlottesville would, at least by custom and habit, been adjudged by a local jury. The vicinage would have been Virginia, the venue would have been here in Charlottesville. But as the nature of the Judiciary Act of 1789 came about, we find that with such a large district that a federal judge might remove the venue of the case to such a place as Richmond or Alexandria, where perhaps a more favorable outcome to a judicial proceeding might be obtained. And this threat certainly was felt by many, including Patrick Henry and Mr. Mason and others, who felt that the nature of the jurisdictions were too broad and not attentive enough to the rights of trial by jury and right to trial by peers, since the venue could be changed so alterably. There are scores of other matters also that would not sit in the nature and comfort of every gentleman who was attendant to the Constitutional Convention, or even those who were party to ratifying that convention. Dr. Franklin himself, at the conclusion, suggested that it may not have been a very good document, but it was certainly the best document that was at hand. And it would behoove the people to support those measures, which may even be contrary to their own spirit, in order to have the effect of the whole secured. And in this respect, I believe that the Constitution then may not be described as any handiwork of my own. You mentioned that I have been called the father of the Constitution. I can personally attest that I'm father to nothing, sir, despite my domestic efforts to the contrary. And that one may conceive the Constitution to the work of many heads and many hands. And in that respect, it's more representative of the will of the people and to the spirit which the people demanded of their new government. Yes?
Mr. Secretary, it is said that during the Constitutional Convention, when Mr. Mason argued for the inclusion of a Bill of Rights, you argued against it. And then yet you sponsored same when it came to that. And it has been adopted. Why the flip-flop? And are you happy with the results?
Well, the characterization of a flip-flop is your own, sir. It's not one that I would adopt for myself. There's good reason. When one considers a Bill of Rights during the Constitutional Convention, it was, number one, introduced at the latter part of the convention where many were already fatigued. And the idea of addressing a whole new set of principles to attach to the Constitution would have embroiled the convention into further debates and extending the time of the convention itself. Secondly, one would consider that of a Bill of Rights, which presumably is a statement of the natural rights of citizens, and those civil rights that would support and certainly secure those natural rights, were already found in 8 of the 13 constitutions of the several state governments, and that there was nothing in the national government that would abridge those bills of rights either attached to or incorporated in the several respective state governments. So there's no action taken in the government that would abridge rights of free speech. The government was not given any right to abridge free speech, so it was a moot point to include that right in the Constitution. Thirdly, one may consider that the Constitution itself is a document that limits the scope and breadth of the powers of the national government, leaving all other powers to the states. State governments, by their very nature, are plenary. They retain all rights of actions against the people within their own constituency. The federal government, the national government, is not plenary. It is restricted to those powers specifically vested to it. If we introduced a Bill of Rights to the Constitution, it would change the nature of that Constitution considerably. Instead of a limitation of the powers of the federal government or the national government, it would then be a litany of rights to the extent of which, upon the people, if incomplete, would have the effect of implying that any rights not mentioned in the Bill of Rights at the federal level would then be powers thus given over to the general government by implication. That is a dangerous position in which to put this new government. To try to include in the Bill of Rights all those rights attendant to the people. In matter of natural rights, the force of language itself becomes inefficacious the more words you use to describe the natural right you possess. The words themselves are restricted. They are limited. Perhaps if rights were descended and granted to the people by the government, one could argue for written statements of a Bill of Rights. But rights, the natural rights of which we were describing in 1776 and 1787, and even in 1791, these are natural rights given to us by the mere possession of temporal existence. Any attempt to describe those rights or to render an account complete would be difficult at best and most likely impossible to achieve. And hence the reason for objecting to a Bill of Rights at the time of the Constitutional Convention. In the time after the Constitution was written and the process of ratifying conventions in the several states, one of the objections that was given, and certainly most pronouncedly by Mr. Mason, as Mr. Taylor suggests, was that the Constitution did not possess a Bill of Rights, that the people felt a Bill of Rights were necessary, that by an expression of such a Bill of Rights, the paper document itself would not necessarily be sufficient to protect those rights, but over a period of time, it would inculcate into the American mind the nature that those rights exist, that there are such rights. And hence, the addition of these rights to the national constitution were not such a flip-flop as some might wish to suggest. It is to bring ease to the public mind. It is to suggest that though the document itself would not protect these rights, that the government was aware that such rights exist. And even in those 10 amendments that were added to the Constitution, there's a reference in one of those amendments that those rights, just because they're stated, are not complete in and of themselves. That there may be other rights not so enumerated that still may be retained by the people at large. The protection. And so at first, the Bill of Rights was not necessary for the writing of the Constitution. Its introduction at the Constitutional Convention would have only confuted the matter, lengthened the convention, and perhaps rendered it unable to come to any conclusion at all. And after the Constitution was written, the ratifying conventions convened, the statement of the people in those conventions mentioning the desire for such a Bill of Rights, and if such a Bill of Rights could be written without any detriment to the national constitution itself, then I found that there was no reason to keep a Bill of Rights from the Constitution, as long as it would not endanger the document itself. I believe when one reviews both the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, they will see that the Bill of Rights only adds to the public ease and the public mind, their comfort, and does not in any way detract from the federal government. Yes, sir.
You say if you're an agricultural enterprise, that's not peculiar given the fact that you're most preoccupied with the affairs of state. As the agricultural enterprise?
Not
peculiar, suffering just you being engaged in the affairs of state.
The question is, are my affairs, the agricultural affairs at Montpelier, suffering in consequence of my being Secretary of State? It is to be noted, of course, that I am gone from the plantation a great deal of time, but we've made considerable changes at Montpelier over the last several years. Certainly with the death of my father, the responsibilities of Montpelier fell on my shoulders in 1801, shortly before I made my way to Washington City to become Secretary of State in May. My father died in February that year in 1801. And previous to that time, my father was assisted until 1793 by my brother Ambrose, who was very active in the plantation itself. But we also changed at Montpelier our general crops, mostly to wheat and other grains, which require far less attention and care, far less expense of our people to run, and far less attention necessary on a day-by-day nature to the success of that plantation. Any gentleman who assumes public office, who commits himself to from a county sheriff to the President of the United States, will suffer in his own affairs in consequence of his contribution to the country at large. It is to be noted that any public servant that you have is in his position in consequence of great sacrifice to himself. The various individuals who would consistently insist upon the reprehensible behavior of their representatives, the reprehensible behavior of the government at large in the town or in the county or in the state or in the national government, must keep in mind that the gentlemen who are there in their positions are there in a virtuous attempt to assist that government. That is the hope of the people who sent them there. And as a consequence, one must make that sacrifice. I don't believe my sacrifice has been as grave as others have been, but it does take into account whether I purchase another coach from Philadelphia or not, and I don't think it's likely to occur.
I promised the Secretary that he would be able to leave for his trip back to Washington City at a relatively early hour, despite his graciousness of being with us tonight. So I think we have time for one more question.
Yes, ma'am.
I just wondered how the development of the Washington City is coming along.
The lady asked how the development of Washington City is coming along. I wear boots there. There are a number of boarding houses that are being constructed. In the time from 1791, when it was decided to put the permanent seat of government along the banks of the Potomac, the issue of the permanent seat of government had been a very prominent issue amongst many of the states shortly after the Revolution was concluded, certainly, and the years there following. It was suggested for a long while that a permanent seat of government might be placed between Lancaster and Germantown in western Pennsylvania along the Susquehanna. The effort also at that time, shortly after the Revolution, was to increase the trade between those lands west of the Appalachians and east of the Mississippi. Since the closure of the port of Mississippi had been affected by the Spanish, the only route for trade for those west of the Appalachians was over the mountain, and presumably down three routes, the Susquehanna River and the James River and the Potomac River. As a consequence, three river companies were established after the war, the Susquehanna River Company, the Potomac River Company, and the James River Company, all endeavoring to create routes. These river companies of necessity were to build locks at the various fall lines of those rivers. James Brindley from Pennsylvania was a remarkable engineer and was called upon both by the James River Company and Potomac River Company to assist them in the building of those locks, and much as he had done in the Susquehanna River Company. But the nature of the place in the government there between Lancaster and Germantown was an effort to place the government along a water route, but sufficiently inland from danger from abroad. And we were able to keep the decision of the permanent seat of government as an open question on the table until 1791, when it was determined that we might more fairly place the seat of government equidistant from the extremes of the nation, again along one of those river routes that would make its way to the west. The city had to be built from scratch. And there were three commissioners, Mr. Carroll, Mr. Stewart, and Mr. Ellicott, who were appointed by the Congress to assist Mr. Washington in the first of the surveys of those lands at 10 square miles, and then to assist in Pierre L'Enfant to designing streets and routes and avenues for an elegant city. The elegance that L'Enfant had sought has not yet been effected. It may also be of interest to you people that before the decision was made for the permanent seat of government, Virginia in legislative act offered $150,000 to the United States and Congress assembled to have the permanent seat of government located entirely in Virginia. And that shortly thereafter, Maryland had offered $75,000 to 10 square miles to have that 10 square miles placed in Maryland. So the precedent for Virginia and Maryland being together on this particular project was very great. And some of the representatives in Maryland and Virginia both worked to have this permanent seat of government placed where it is. It incorporates the city of Alexandria, the town of Georgetown, and Bladensburg. The position of the seven buildings where I now am occupied with the Secretary of State are some distance from the White House, the footpaths that run all the way through the city. Aside from such entourages as General Thoreau, the ambassador from France, who has a rather elegant carriage and six horses to pull it, these sights are not really often seen in Washington City. Many of the representatives do stay in boarding houses near the Capitol that is still being built, and some reside in Alexandria and other towns about. But I would not wish to excite your anticipation for what you may see if you were to go to Washington City presently. I thank all of you for being here, and I charge all of you, of course, with the responsibility that you might accept as citizens, that one successful republic is dependent upon the citizens themselves not deferring their responsibilities onto the shoulders of others. It is absolutely necessary for people to contemplate, to review the actions and the news that arrives day by day, to assemble those individuals on whom you may be dependent for information and for their respective views, to seek them out, and to register your own opinions to those representatives and to those other individuals. This republic has a bright future above it, but the nature of the republic can either descend into the abyss or certainly rise to a plateau that may be a shining beacon for nations around. Is it not the glory of America that whilst we've paid a decent respect to former times and other nations, we have not fallen prey to former ties or people or traditions that have undermined our sense, our own good sense, that have influenced our knowledge of our own situation? All of these matters are a reflection of the people that we are as a whole. And any weakening in the chain may weaken the whole. We have an old saying where I come from that in times of vacillation and procrastination, there are two ways to get to the top of an oak tree. That one can either climb it or sit on an acorn and wait. And I hope indeed you'll all rise to the occasion. Thank you very much.